Succession number 27460, reel 28.
Mr. Wilkes, reel 28. You're talking about your journey home.
Yes. Well, going back, when the war was officially over, quite a few of us thought, well, now we've been on this Mepocrin for a long time, and if when we get home we do get malaria, it might not be recognised by the doctors, who might not have seen any of this. And so quite a number of us stopped taking the Mepocrins at night, in the belief that if the malaria showed up, the doctors out there would recognise it and we could be treated, which is exactly what had happened. And I went down with malaria on the ship and was treated and was okay. So began the journey home. And then I know that when we're coming through the Mediterranean, one of the crew died in his sleep. He'd had a fit and swallowed his tongue, and so we had to have a burial at sea. And as was the custom, at sundown the ship's engines were stopped, and mind, the ship was still drifting along, but we could see sharks in the water. And the committal was carried out, and we saw these sharks just dive, and that was the last we saw of them. And so I said to this seaman that I'd talked to previously, once the engine started up, there was this terrible vibration on the ship. And it had concerned me, because I think things should run smoothly. And so anyway, he told me, he said, "You talk about that?" He said, "It's always had that." He said, "You should have seen it the night the Jarvis Bay was sunk." Now, that was an Atlantic convoy that this ship had been on at one time. And when the convoy had got the order to scatter, where the normal speed of that ship was 18 knots, they'd got 22 out of it. He said, then she was shaking and vibrating.
I think she had the nickname of the Drunken Duchess.
She did. That was it. And the reason for that was because she had a flat bottom for getting up the St. Lawrence. She was just one of two that survived the war. And she finally burnt out in Liverpool docks.
Did you have duties to perform on the voyage?
Not me. I seemed to escape them all.
How do you fill your time in on board the ship every day for quite a long journey?
Reading most of the time. It was nice just to relax. And, you know, the malaria had left me terribly weak. And I was trying to get myself pulled together. And whereas I'd mentioned I was just seven stone six at Schwebo, when I got home I was just 9 stone 3. So I had put some weight on, but never mind.
And the sea journey, did you find the journey pleasant in itself?
I enjoy sailing, and so I enjoyed the sea journey. I wasn't at all sick. And there was plenty of food. And, you know, you could enjoy the food.
Now, what kind of food were you getting? Was it an improvement on what you had, obviously?
Oh, yes, you got the norm. And, you see, that ship had provisioned in Canada. So everything was of the best. Bacon, eggs, you name it, we got it. They were trying to fatten us up before we got home.
You got to the Mediterranean. Now, you're coming out, you'd come round Africa, hadn't you?
Not coming back, no.
Yeah, but coming out, I think you'd come...
Going out, yes.
Now you're going through the Mediterranean. How did you find that particular aspect?
Well, I would have loved it if we'd been able to sail through the Suez during the day, but we went through at night. So we saw very little of it.
Did you get ashore in any of the ports?
No.
It was on board ship all the time.
And when we came to the west end, shall I say, of the Suez, west or north end, There was such a conglomeration of ships of all sizes. And I know we were so close to a ship full of Americans that some of our chaps were actually hanging on to each other's ankles and trying to reach across to shake hands with them. But they just couldn't make it. It was a long drop to the bottom if they didn't, so they left it. So that was that. So we eventually pulled out of there. I can't remember now if that was Port Tewfik or Port Said, but anyway, it was this end. And we sailed and we met the Nelson on its way heading out to the Far East, and it was carrying troops. And those people that could read signals, read the signals from the Nelson, wishing us a Merry Christmas, you lucky so-and-sos.
And you continued your journey?
Yes, and eventually we were approaching Liverpool, and typical English weather, November, thick fog, and I remember the ship had slowed right down. It was coming up between all these buoys, just travelling at a nice steady pace, and the pilot had come aboard, and we were coming up, and eventually we got into the dock area and they let the anchors go, and this was about 5 minutes to 11. And
on the what day was
it? On the 17th of November.
As he predicted.
Yes. And I think the anchor would hardly hit the base, the bottom, when it was coming back up again, and the tugs had come round and they were pushing us, and then the brass bands all started playing on the quayside.
That must have been a wonderful moment.
Oh, it was. And this chap, McGuinness, whose Bren carrier I'd been driving, his family, of course, their business was in Liverpool. They were on the quayside. He'd been able to send a cable to them.
I was going to ask you, had you been able to get information home to your wife that you were coming?
Well, I didn't send any. I thought, what's the use? If I meet her at Darlington, that'll be enough harassment for her. So, anyway, those that had relations were allowed into a certain part of the ship to meet them. The rest of us from my regiment, we were confined back to on the mess deck. But then all the heating went off and it began to get terribly cold. We got our lunch that day, and after that we were just given a packed meal which was to be consumed sometime later on, because we were going to disembark at 2:15 in the morning. Of course, troops were going ashore all the time, but to get 3,500 troops off isn't a 5-minute job. So we had to wait until 2:15 in the morning and we'd eaten our...
Did you have to go through customs?
No, we thought we would, but nobody troubled us. During this time, all our kit that had been in the hold had been taken into a big warehouse and laid out alphabetically, very well organised. And so, 2:15 in the morning, we disembarked. We went and collected our kit and made our way across to a train that was standing on beside the platform. And we got aboard, and immediately the WRVS, the Salvation Army, TOC H, goodness knows, everyone was coming aboard. We got plenty of hot tea, which was a good thing. And I don't know which lot, I think it was the Salvation Army gave us each 2 cigarettes, which we passed along, not being a smoker. We got a copy of the Manchester Guardian, that morning's copy of the Manchester Guardian, and a sandwich from someone, a bun from someone else, and eventually the train would move off. And the trouble was, the train wasn't heated. Coming from the tropics, we were frozen. And a few of us We tried at various stations when the train stopped to nip into the buffets and see if we could get a cup of tea, but invariably the train signalled it was leaving just when you were about to be served, so you didn't get any. So the train would take us to Clacton-on-Sea, which was Butlin's holiday camp, or had been, and was commandeered by the army. And eventually we arrived there at 6 o'clock in the evening. And we were perished and hungry and tired, because we hadn't any sleep the night before, and, well, never mind. We had to get off the train, and there was a sergeant, a cocky little beggar, and I don't think he'd ever been out of this country, but he was full of his own importance, and he was shouting orders, but he soon got put in his place. We put our kit onto trucks, and we had to march then from the station to Butlin's. And we smelt fish and chips as we went along the road. Then they did smell.
Did you have people out watching you coming, going along?
No.
There's no way.
It was dark. No. We're just marching in the dark. And at 6 o'clock at night, you see. And we finally got into the main dining hall and had to get our kit off the lorries and just dump it in one corner. And the officer in charge there was very nice, apologised. He says, "We've done our best. We only got to know at lunchtime that you were coming. We'll do our best." But he said, "We want you to get a meal now, and then we'll see what we can find out after that." And so it was wonderful to get a good meal. And we were offered seconds. Those of us could eat it, and we could, or most of us could anyway. After the meal, we were told we had to go and hand our pay books in, and we would draw four blankets each, and we'd be staying the night there. So, and they would be arranging for passes and things for us. So, a friend and I, we went to one chalet, no electric light, God, was it cold, concrete floor, no beds, so we pooled our blankets, but I couldn't sleep, it was too cold, and I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I went round into the dining hall, which was warmer, but still very cold, and I'd had a wash and a cold shave, and I just sat in the dining hall till the cooks came in, and then I managed to get a mug of tea for myself, and when I'd drunk that, I got another one and took it to my pal. Of course, he had all the blankets, so he could sleep. Then breakfast time, well, we all had our breakfast, and there wasn't any heating in the hall. It was just the amount of men that helped to warm it up a bit. So we had that, and then we were addressed and told that there wasn't going to be much chance of us getting home. This was a Saturday, and the railway company couldn't possibly cope with all these troops till we got away. But never mind, they would keep on trying and see if they could get some of us away.
That must have been disappointing.
It was.
Did some people take it rather badly?
Well, we'd been used to so many disappointments, I think we just took it philosophically. However, lunchtime came, and we were told that there was going to be a parade, then there wasn't, and there was, and there wasn't, but there was. And we were told that they'd talked to the British Rail, well, it wasn't British Rail in those days, it was the railway company, and they had put an extra train or two on, so we'd be able to get away. So we got our passes, and I know that I didn't have to report back to Woolwich until the 2nd of January 1946. So, was it 6 weeks and 2 days, I think, my leave was. So I wasn't sorry about that. And so when we got our passes and our pay and everything that was necessary, we left. And we went down And we're told there's a train that would take us to... oh dear, the name of the station has just avoided me now. It's a big military place as well, so we would go there. But the train was 3:15, so but the train was already in. So I put my kit on one of these trolleys, and my friend said, "I'll go and see to it." And I said, "Don't you want to send a telegram?" "No," he says, "I'll wait till we get a bit nearer home, and phone home." So I said, "Righto." So I went to the booking office and I checked up on the times of the train, and my train would get into Darlington at 2:09 in the morning. So I sent a telegram to that effect to my wife and went back, and I had plenty of time, just in time to see the train pulling out of the station. It was away. So I said to the porter, I said, "You told me it didn't go till 3:15. "Oh," he said, "this is a duplicate for the troops." He says, "There's the one at platform so-and-so." He said, "They'll link up further down, don't worry." So I waited and met up with my friend. And he says, "I've left all your bloody kit for you to carry, so I wasn't going to carry that lot over." You had to cross the railway line. Where they had sleepers laid between the lines, you had to cross. So he wasn't going to cross doing that. I said, "Right." And so then we managed to get one or two sandwiches and things like that while we were waiting. It was getting on into the evening. And we finally got a train that would take us to York. And whilst on the train, I managed to get a good wash and a shave. That train was heated. And there was some warm water in the wash basin, so I got a wash and a shave and felt a lot better for it. And I forgot to mention, before we got off the ship, my legs had broken out with jungle sores. Rather than go and see the medical officer, I just went to the dressing parade. The orderly that dealt with me, he says, "The doctor should really see these." He says, "But," he says, "you'll be put in quarantine when you get off the ship." He said, "Look," he says, "I'll bandage them up for you." He says, "But say nothing to anybody and don't take the bandages off till you get home," which I didn't.
What caused them? I know those cells, but how had they been caused?
I think possibly a lot of malnutrition, and it would just take the slightest abrasion to set them running. And they were nasty. They just used to leak and dribble down your legs. So, anyway, apart from those, I was feeling quite fit and looking forward to getting home. And when we got to York, that train was running late. And we didn't get into Darlington until 3:10 in the morning. And there were so many people waiting at the station to welcome us all. So it was very hard. It was a while before I finally recognised my wife through the railings, and then I spotted her and went up. And she had a car there, a taxi, to take us both home. So said cheerio to our others, and everyone had their own arrangements. And made our way back to the farm, where there was a party laid on.
And of course, it must have been a wonderful moment. How did you settle down to... I know you're 6 weeks' leave, which is a long leave, but you're in a civilian situation, you're not in camp.
Yes.
How did you settle down to home life?
I settled down very easily, but I think I was getting itchy feet before it got to the end. I think being a nomad for as long had its calling again, but... Never mind, I did get involved. I'd done, repaired a tractor, and I'd my brother-in-law's car broke the back axle a day or two after I'd got home, after they'd been visiting us. And so I felt obliged to try and get that going. It took me a week or so to get the parts. Hunting, we couldn't get new, we had to look for second-hand. And that particular model had so many variations, it was hard to get the right combination. But we got it going.
On a personal note, it's happened with quite a number of people. Relationships with your wife, they just... You didn't have any problems there? You know?
No, I mean, just...
War hadn't changed you from the person you would be.
No, I think we were so dedicated to each other. We were just there for each other. The letters and things that we'd exchanged and that sort of thing, and we'd just kept everything going.
And for 6 weeks, you were getting into the normal life, you might say, your tractors and your cars and so forth.
Oh, yes. And, of course, there were lots of visiting to be done. And I visited my mother. And, of course, the balloon went up then and she wouldn't entertain me at all and wouldn't entertain my wife or anything.
It must have been very distressing.
Oh, it that threw a damper on everything. So, never mind, I got over that. And the day came when I had to report back to Woolwich. So two or three of us had met up on the train by arrangement. So we went to Woolwich Barracks. But I was only there a day or two, and I was farmed out then to London District Workshops, which was down on the Purley Way at Croydon. And I seemed to run into trouble there, because in the first instance, I'd been used to working on my own with no one telling me anything. Then there was a foreman, a civilian. I know I'd done this front axle for a Morris pickup, and I'd put it all together and set the bearings and everything as they should be set, and I'd split the pins as had to be, ready for the axle being put back in. And this, who'd given me authority to do this? Who'd done this? You've never had this checked. You've just built it all up yourself. And he was on more money an hour than I was on a day. So, never mind. We stripped it out again and let him please himself and kept putting it back into, put this little bit back, and then he would come and check and put it back. I thought, what a waste of time, a waste of everything. So, anyway, I managed to get a 48 hours leave while I was there and went home, but unfortunately I was so ill. I got home on the Saturday lunchtime and I was no use. Sunday night, my wife didn't want me to come away. She wanted to get a doctor. Oh, I said, I've got 48 hours. I mustn't be absent. So I went back, and of course by Monday morning I'm fine, feeling fine. That's how malaria hits you. So a day or two later I was feeling ill again. Saw the medical officer. Oh, he says, you've just got a touch of flu. He says, you're making mountains out of molehills. It's nothing. Anyway, I picked up a day or two later, and then down I went again. And he gave me a good telling off, and he said, go to bed and stop there till the weekend. So I went, and of course I was feeling better all the time. On the Saturday morning, once again, I was ill, and really ill. And the billet orderly, because we were in a big house which was used for civilian billets, and the orderly would send word that I needed to see a medical officer, and he knew I was ill. This lad knew. Vomiting and one thing and another. So anyway, the medical officer wouldn't come. And he said I had to make my own way down there. So somehow they managed to arrange for a truck to come and pick me up, driven by an ATS. And this vehicle just had these little windscreens, one in front of the driver and one in front of the passenger. They were so small. And it was a bitter cold, frosty day. And I was shivering, and the medical officer was leaving the dressing station. He came up the parade ground, and he met the truck, and he gave me another telling off, and he said they'd put me into hospital. So I had to be taken down to the office. I had to gather all my kit up, go down to the office and wait then for an ambulance, which eventually came in the afternoon, but it had been lost on the way. But what a super girl was driving it. I was feeling a bit better by now, and we got in. I sat down on the stretcher in the back of the ambulance, but she knew what she was doing, and she just gave me a poke in the chest and tipped me over my legs, and she had my legs fastened on down with straps, ready to take me. And we went to the guards depot at Caterham, and when we got there, there was a very nice sister in charge, and I could see she had some medal ribbons up. And she sat me down in the office. She said, any idea what it might be? I said, well, from the symptoms, I said, I've had both malaria and dengue fever. And I said, it could be either. So she said, oh, we'll get you checked. So she would check my temperature, which at this stage now was at 101. And I was supposed to be feeling better at that, which I was. So I was put into the hospital, and she had an orderly put a hot water bottle in the bed for me. She said, you'll be cold. And she'd give me a hot cup of tea in her office. And she'd wanted to know whereabouts I'd been and one thing and another. So I went into the ward, and there were two old soldiers in there, and the rest were all National Service. Maximum service, 3 weeks. And they all were down with colds and one thing and another. So Saturday went by. I was feeling champion Sunday morning. And then I knew I had some friends coming in to see me from Woolwich. And I was writing a letter to my wife when they arrived. And I put it to one side. And when they arrived, I began to feel so ill I felt terrible. So they went. They just left word at the office that there was just an orderly on duty at the time, and he came and he saw I was ill. And so they sent for the sister, who came round and, During the day, two young medical officers had come and they'd taken blood samples off me. And they would start treating me for malaria to start with. And I think the treatment is the same for both, so they were on the right horse anyway.
And what is the treatment? Just quinine?
Quinine, yes.
Mm-hmm. Same treatment?
I think so, yes. So I began to feel worse and worse during the night. And when it came to morning, when they brought the gunfire round at first light, and I couldn't manage any tea or anything, and when the sister came round with the medical officers, it was reported I'd not managed to have any tea, I'd not had any breakfast, and had a very high temperature. So, anyway, they were getting a bit concerned, and the sister, she was very understanding, and she said, look, she said, if I make you some tea in a special teacup, will you try and get it down for me? I said, I'll do my best. And I kept getting doses of quinine and bringing it back up and trying to keep tea down. And I vomited. It was something terrible. And that's how the day went. And during the course of the day, they stopped the radio being on in the ward. You want to stop it there?